南無妙法蓮華経。南無妙法蓮華経。Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. What a gorgeous, magnificent day. It is so amazing to be alive in this time. In this time of technology. In this time of the earth. In this time of our Buddhist practice. It's really moment to moment, just joy to be experienced constantly makes us wonder why it is do we spend so much time in misery? Why do we do that? It's so unnecessary. But that's part of samsara. We have to learn how to change our perception of this gargantuan opportunity. Right? The opportunity to witness in each and every moment the insane, really mind-boggling, instead of insane, right? A better word. Mind-altering functions of the universe, which you and I experience locally in our little tiny way with our eyes, ears, nose, throat, on, and our minds. This process, it's so... The more we realize how gargantuan this life activity is, I believe it's all the more humbling. This little human being with little arms and fingers and legs, and we're bopping around, moving thousands of miles per hour through space-time, and it's so huge. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. Friends, thank you for being here. Thank you for supporting this channel. Thank you for being a part of this sangha. Right? Let's together aim our minds and our imagination toward the grandeur of every single moment that our existence experiences. Yeah. I really mean that. Take some time to look at how awesome the simplicities are. Right? I went and walked around a local lake some time ago, and there was some sand on the beach, and I just picked up the wet sand. I was just looking at the granules and the way they stick and fall. And it just was, I know it sounds silly on the surface, but if you really let yourself get involved in just the beingness of that and it's really incredible. I highly suggest that if you're going to look at nature or your environs or your look at your children, your so on and so forth. whatever it is that you bring your focus in on, chant. Enliven your Buddha mind before and even during, but certainly before. Prepare your mind to be blown. Right? It's just like focusing a camera. Focus your mind like you focus a camera. It's upsetting and highly unsatisfying to look through a camera and see a blurred image. The more blurry, the more upsetting. You quickly want to get that camera into focus. Well, that's not unlike what we do when we chant. We get our mind, our observer, into focus. So that we don't get misled by, what's that blob? What's that blob? I don't like that. Wait, whoa, 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 you're imposing all kinds of judgment. Stop. Don't judge, just be, just focus. All right. That's my little absurd rant for today. Now we're going to get into ontology and the twofold egolessness. Let's see what Mr. Suzuki has to say about that subject in Mahayana. And once again, to remind you, we're reading Suzuki's introduction because it's lengthy, because its purpose, proposed purpose, is to expose us to Mahayana thinking so that as we read his translation of the Vallankavatara Sutra, we will have this base of knowledge going into it. So I'm giving him the full shot, yeah? I've had some issues with his understanding of Mahayana. It's somewhat incomplete. Still not sure whether he's imposing that incompleteness on his description of Mahayana because it's a translation of the Vallankavatara, a specific period of the teachings. But he's not, you know, he vacillates back and forth. He proposes this introduction as an introduction to Mahayana, which is far more general than the Vallankavatara. And at many moments, he chooses to say in the Vallankavatara, this, this, this. So, yeah, I've pointed out some misconceptions, some missing components, like the ninth consciousness, and some out-and-out errors. He keeps adjusting, though. It seems like he's torn between, this is what I've been told, but I don't get it, and this is what I think. And this is what I get. And he vacillates a little bit. So we're getting a clue as to our author here, right? But it's good for us because from the lotus of our, the perspective of our Lotus Sutra practice and our ultimate teachings of Mahayana, we can look upon Mr. Suzuki and this translation with a clever eye of understanding, yeah? So let's get into it. Ontology and the twofold egolessness. What the heck do you mean? Okay. In considering the theory of mind only, yeah, let's explore that because that's a big amorphous umbrella term. So let's get into it. We have to be careful not to understand this term psychologically, which we've already identified psychology as being about samsaric mind, yeah? Qualities of a samsaric physical reality. So mind, when we talk about mind in Buddhism, is not an organ or something we can dissect or a neurological physical network, right? There's a lot of that in our bodies, but the mind is not that. The mind is our emergent property, a property that only exists with this apparatus for it to emerge from, right? It's like we can analyze H2O and water all day long. heavy atoms, so on and so forth. We can really get into the chemistry and biology of water. But water has its temperature. And the temperature of water, whether it's cool and refreshing or hot and boiling, whatever, those are emergent properties. Our sensation of what water is an emergent property. It requires a relationship. Follow? So in my example, the mind, your mind, my mind, exists through a relationship of this ego self, this constructed self, and the environment, the entire universe in which this manifests. Because of that relationship, there's a mind that emerges. And you could say the mind that emerges specifically to negotiate this relationship, self and other, as coming together in one mind. To see that the relationship is based on a construction and the reality of our existence in this environment is that it's happening all at the same time, moment to moment. There is no separation. The mind can do that because it's an emergent property. It's kind of a conundrum, isn't it? We have a mind because of duality, and the mind itself is non-dual. And only the mind can perceive that. That's the ninth consciousness. It doesn't exist anywhere else. So once again, we disabuse ourselves of the notion that ego identity, came from somewhere else and are going to somewhere else. No, that's the province of religion, assuming that the self is some permanent thing. Or thingness, suchness. The suchness of Buddha-ness is the suchness of a momentary, moment-to-moment, perceptive reality that's from an emergent property of the system itself. This is why it is a potential that is always there, but it only manifests in our experience. Follow? I haven't even gotten past the first sentence. Mind, or citta, here does not mean our individual mind, which is subject to the law of causation, in others, samsaric. Absolute citta transcends the dualistic conception of existence, exactly what I've been saying. It belongs neither to the Vijnana system nor to our objective world or Vishaya. Therefore, in the Lanka, this citta is frequently described in ontological terms. Okay. The most significant one is vastu, which is found coupled with tathata in one place, in page 147, line say, okay, and with arya in another place, page 164, blah, blah, blah. In the first case, vastu and tathata are synonymously used. What is tathata? That is vastu. Tathata is to be rendered either suchness or thatness. Slippery. Which is a term most frequently used in the Mahayana text to designate the highest reality ever approachable by prajna, with the mind, wisdom, yeah? Transcendental wisdom, to be more specific, he says. Vastu in Buddhism is usually an individual object regarded as existing externally to the Vijnanas And so it is in most cases in the Lanka also. But evidently in this connection where Vastu is Tathata, it must mean the highest reality. So again, here he's vacillating between a mind that is an integration, all-knowing, and a mind that is wise outside of the samsaric experience, a duality. And he's having a hard time navigating that, but he's trying to demonstrate that the Lanka has that issue in it, or at least in his translation of it. So that's interesting. We'll see how that plays out as we read this translation of the Lankavatara Sutra, yeah? In the second case, in which Arya is affixed to Vastu, the Arya must be a modifier here. That is, this reality is something to be described as Arya, noble, holy, or worthy. So this is a differently distinguished citta, position of mind. The highest reality is also called something that has been in existence since the very first, the purva dharma sthitita, As it is the most ancient reality, its realization means returning to one's own original abode, in which everything one sees around is an old familiar object. This, I would say, again, is an ontological struggle of a samsaric mind to identify a past, an original point. And this is where Nichiren grapples with this in a different way, and he demonstrates that Tendai was one who spent a lot of time concentrating and describing and defining this idea of original enlightenment, the original Buddha. And there's a problem in the language there, because to think of original enlightenment or original Buddha, and I've talked about this before, with our samsaric minds, we kind of want to envision in that language a little guy sitting on a flower at the beginning of the universe. And again, I've talked about this, not the little guy, as Buddha, an image of a form that instantiates with the universe. That's because of the limitation of our samsaric perception of dualities, right? What original enlightenment is truly about, and Nichiren spends some time on this, exploring Shakyamuni's own words, that this, if you view Buddha-ness as a consciousness of a process that starts from noumena, no thing, formations, forms, without ever getting to the forms themselves, you start to identify a moment, a sliver in the process of life, what we call life, which is in fact the entire universe, this engine that creates, or more accurately, instantiates from potential. Everything's an instantiation, a manifestation of amalgams of energy. But you have to understand that before there are golf balls, there is an energetic momentum toward the creation of the golf ball. It comes before the form. There is an energy there. Not a will, not a volition. We can use those words, but those imply a thinker. They imply an already extant form in order to manifest it. That's the samsaric mind we're trying to separate from our Buddha mind, which doesn't give a flip about what it's doing. It just does. It is in every quark. It's in every sub particle. It's in the energy itself, the perturbations of energy that formations lead to, whatever energies amalgam into. It's preform. It's the actual engine. And, you know, samsarically, we're not in a position to just look around and see that. All we're seeing is the lights from the fireworks. We're seeing the sparks of the activity of the formations. We're playing in the forms, which is how we become so attached. Forms not only from what we possess or that possess us, but intimately, the very cells of our bodies, right? I just saw a video where on the ISS, the International Space Station, scientists were looking at cells of heart tissue, and the cells were beating. Mind blown. You mean the stuff the heart is made of is already beating? That's its nature? Wait a minute, right? Kind of stuff blows our minds. So the engine of the heart isn't the heart. It's not even the muscle. Look at the cells of the muscle. They're happily doing, manifesting their potential. Oh man, that's so huge. But this is before he's talking about 8 consciousnesses, not 9. So there's this mistake of inculcating this amazing process of formation into physical form. That's wrong. That's not Buddhism. And unfortunately, this is where this idea of everything around us is an old familiar object. You know, you're stuck in the world of form there. You don't get it. And so the very next sentence, in Zen Buddhism, therefore, the experience is compared to the visiting one's native home and quietly getting settled. The Buddha's enlightened ones are all abiding here as gold is embedded in the mine. The ever-enduring reality is above changes. See, that's a total ricochet, total miss. It's not above changes. It is the engine of change itself. To be above changes means to remain in one's own abode, not to move away from it, and for this reason, reality is known as self-abiding, or remaining in its own abode. To keep one's own abode is to be single, solitary, absolute. Hence, reality is vivekadamra, a thing of solitude, limit of reality, which points to a similar mode of thinking. It is again ekagra, the summit of oneness, and this summit or limit is at the same time no summit, no limit, because this is gained only when one makes a final leap beyond the manifoldness of things. Wow, what a word salad. Well, Zen can be termed a word salad in its entirety. It's an intellectual la-la land. It misses the point entirely, unfortunately. But it has had many, many followers. It's one of the areas of, I have a great respect for Alan Watts. And he speaks eloquently about the nature of reality. But he did get stuck by the Zen bug. I don't think he manifested a true perspective of a Zen practitioner. He was an intellectual and a teacher, a professor. And there was a lot in the rich writings of the Lankavatara that are appropriated by Zen, which he used to talk about reality and Buddhism and so on. And his field of study was more about the psychological experience of life than the transcendent experience of life. But he's talked about eloquently about that as well. So he wasn't strictly Zen. I wouldn't put that label on him. But he did cull a lot of his talks from these sutras, which are falsely identified as belonging to Zen. Zen got a lot of its rhetoric from the Lankavatara, as well as other Shakyamuni's writings and sutras, but they also brought to their practice outside scholarship, not from Shakyamuni. So they built their own system of thinking about the mind, yeah? Something that Nichiren abhors. Nichiren is a purist, right? The more ordinary expressions given to the highest reality known as citta are tathata, suchness, or thusness. Satyata, the state of being true, buddhata, the state of being real, and dharmadhatu, realm of truth. Nirvana, the permanent, nitya, sameness, samatha, and one, advaya. Cessation, nirodha, the formless, animitta, emptiness, sunyata, etc. So you see, a lot of these terms are appropriated into Zen, but they're not Zen concepts. They're just appropriated. A lot of this language comes, we've read it in Nagarjuna, which some Zen schools consider one of their patriarchs. It gets muddy where one begins and one ends, yeah? But let's stick, as Nichiren, our mentor, does with Shakyamuni's texts, words, no text, but you understand. Teachings. From these descriptions, it is found natural for Mahayanists, psychologically, to deny the existence of an ego soul or ego substance in the Alaya, and ontologically to insist that the tragedy of life comes from believing in the substantiality or finality of an individual object. The former is technically called the doctrine of the pudgala nairatya, or egolessness of persons. Let's see, he's got a footnote here. The conception of the Tathagata Garbha is not to be confused with that of the Pudgala or Atman, which I pointed out before, is that discussion of soul, this pre-existence, this eternal existence of some bag of Betty, yeah? For the non-existence of a personal ego soul and the non-reality of an individual object, see especially pages 61 through 62 of this translation. Okay, so I guess we'll cover that in the Lankavatara. Moving on. And the latter of the Dharma Nairatnya, egolessness of things, the one denies the reality of an ego soul and the other the ultimacy of an individual object. I keep identifying this, but this is the problem with ending our concept of the mind at the eighth consciousness. That's just our samsaric bag of reality. What creates that bag? What creates that formation of attitudes, characteristics, blue eyes versus green eyes, blonde hair versus no hair, so on? What creates the energies that amalgamate to instantiate those realities? What's the starting point? Again, this fascination in the human mind to have a starting point from which everything comes from. We identify everything that way. Hierarchies. Who's the boss? Where do we go? We're always wanting to define these points. And Mahayana, ultimately, especially with the ninth consciousness, identifies that there is no starting point or end point. There is no place from, and there is no place go. That's what keeps us attached and clinging and craving to things. Because this is a marker. This is a mile marker. This is a point. But if you analyze point, you understand that all that is a location. It isn't a thing in itself. You can't measure a point. And you say, well, Sylvain, if I grab a pencil and I smack it on a piece of paper, I made a point. No, you didn't. You made a dot, a thing, and it's located in a specific place, a point, but that's not a point. That's the evidence of having gone to a certain place, but what you have there is measurable. It has characteristics, the color of the lead, the pencil, the dent in the paper, so on and so forth. Those are all things, and none of them are point. This is what's sorely missing in this conversation. Yeah? Do you see what I'm saying? To identify a point is simply a location in time-space. But all locations in time-space are only happening now, 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 now. Yours, mine, they're all perceptions of points in time. But our ability to perceive a point in time has no time of its own. It's only perceivable in the point. Ah. It'll make more sense as we go. Superficially, this denial of the Atman in persons and individual objects sounds negative and productive of no moral signification. But when one understands what is ultimately meant by citta-matra, mind only, or by vivekat-dharma, the solitary, the negations are on the plane of relativity and intellection. The term the middle, or madhyama, meaning the middle way, now we're talking Nagarjuna, right, does not occur in the Lanka proper, except in its Sagathakam portion. But the idea that the truth is not found in the dualistic way of interpreting existence, that it is beyond the category of being and non-being, is everywhere emphasized in the Lanka. In fact, we can say that one of the principal theses of the Lanka is to establish the absolute, which makes a world of particulars possible, but which is not to be grasped by means of being and non-being. This absolute is the middle way of the Madhyamaka school, which is Nagarjuna, right? So interestingly enough, if we can stop referencing the Lankavatara as Zen and understand that this is part of Shakyamuni's teachings, we can see where Tendai gets from Shakyamuni this idea of original enlightenment, a quality of being that is outside being and not being, that it is the engine, the formation, not the forms. It It's pre-life. It is the impetus for life, right? This is why you hear physicists talk about the universe as, you know, when they struggle a lot with the concept of time. Well, time and space, they combine time and space as a duality of the same coin, right? You can't have space without time. You can't have time without space. Well, I would argue there's a third term they should throw in there, is the universe. Because the universe is space and time. Time, space is the universe. And without a universe, there is no time, space. It's that simple. So what generates, what is the progenitor of the universe? Certainly we're back at energy. And energy forms or goes through a formation process with tendencies and conditions to instantiate something. And that process is time, space, universe, /, /, /, time, space, universe, which is where we are precipitated from, instantiated from, that whole, right? So you could use words like the universe is our mother, our womb, to instantiate, and our father is the energies that propagate us through time, space, the universe. You could use those words. And this, I say all of that because here is yet another example of how language tries desperately to conceive of an understanding that is so profound, so all-encompassing, that words ultimately fail it. But certainly, if you were looking for an origin, it would be in this process. Energy to mass, energy to manifestations of unknowable, unfathomable, innumerable combinations, amalgams. I'll remind you right now that the introduction to the Lotus Sutra is called Innumerable Meanings. You could read it as innumerable minds, innumerable witnesses, innumerable ways to witness. Witness what? Self-enlightenment. Witness the process in its entirety without the confines of time-space, outside of formations. Let's just look at the energy of forming without the forms. Buddha-ness. Understand the whole picture. So we're struggling with this in the Lankavatara, according to Mr. Suzuki, or according to us as we read him. We can see the struggle, yeah? But if we understand the Lankavatara as Shakyamuni, Shakyamuni is using words to try to identify this very thing. Shakyamuni is not saying there are nine consciousnesses. He's saying, look at how your mind works. He's pointing to these perceptions, these teachings are in order to open our minds to understanding the process. We stick labels on all of those things to identify, try to capture, making marks in the discussion, in the teaching, benchmarks, yeah? So let's continue a little further. Good, we still have time. From these descriptions, it is found natural for Mahayanists psychologically to deny the existence of the ego or ego substance in the Alaya, and ontologically to insist that the tragedy of life comes from believing in the substantiality or finality of an individual object. To rely on our thingifying is the very problematic in our attachment life, our samsaric life, keeps us from experiencing what I opened with, the sheer amazement that we're in it, that we can observe it, and that we're part of it. The former is technically called the doctrine of, and you know, egolessness of persons, and I read the subtext on that, and the latter that of the egolessness of things. The one denies the reality of ego soul, the other the ultimacy of individual objects. That is the whole thing about substantiality, right? That we perceive all these things as permanent, and we make them like we see the chair and we know the chair is permanent. We can rely on it being there as though there were an energy combination molecule called chair. Well, there isn't. So ultimately, the chair is just a temporary fabrication of samsara. Provisional as it is, we go ahead and use it, but we don't worship it as though it were of its own making, right? I mean, that sounds simple enough, but this is part of the logical understanding linguistically of what we're witnessing moment to moment. So we can appreciate that chair once again from its very non-substantiation. It's a difficult way to think moment to moment, but when we awaken our Buddha-ness, that's how we view everything, as just this like flashes from moment to moment of expression, manifestation, that it didn't manifest 20 years ago and it's still here. That in fact, it's not the same thing it was 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 5 minutes ago. Because everything is constantly manifesting moment to moment. So, chair. Those chairs, they're not the same. They may look the same to a dull mind. Yeah? An ignorant mind. But to a Buddha mind, it's an appreciation for that chair in every single moment because it's coming along with my experience. Point to 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 point. There it is. There it is. I'm doing this with language because I'm really wanting you to get the perspective of energy is without time. Our observer Buddha mind doesn't have a languishing moment to grab, to crave, to possess. It's constantly excited by the being of things. It's a serious mental shift, isn't it? You consider it. Superficially, this denial of an Atman in persons and individual objects sounds negative and productive of no moral signification, but we know better, right? The term middle, Mahayana, means the middle way. We already read this. So now we're going to go to a section he calls unobtainability. Well, that's kind of a logical step from this detachment mind, yeah? But it's a negative way to say it, to say that we can't hold on to anything because we've been fooling ourselves that it's there all the time and labeling it as unobtainable. That still speaks to our samsaric craving, doesn't it? But, you know, it's just a word. Let's see what he means by it. This going beyond all forms of dualism, however differently it may be expressed, whether as being and non-being, or as oneness and manyness, or as this and that, or as causation and no causation, or as form and no form, or as assertion and negation, or as samsara and nirvana, or as ignorance and knowledge, or as work and no work, or as good and evil, or as purity and defilement, or as ego and non-ego, or as worldly and superworldly ad infinitum, this going beyond a world of oppositions and contrasts constitutes one of the most significant thoughts of the Mahayana. Whew, okay. There is nothing real as long as we remain entangled in the skein of relativity, and our sufferings will never come to an end. Well, I could deconstruct his sentence there, and I disagree with some of the words that he used. You know, seeing the process is not unreal. It is real. You could say it is the most real, is to observe everything as it truly is happening. So I don't like his word real there, but he's hitting on something here that we've already talked about, so let's continue. We must therefore endeavor to take hold of reality, but this reality is not something altogether solitary. Everything happens within a context, yeah? Your context, my context, they're just different points of experience. The same thing. For in this case, no one of us will be able to have even a glimpse of it, and if we had, it will turn into something standing in opposition to this world of relativity, which means the loss of solitariness. That is, the solitary now forms part of this world. Again, I have to say that this view comes from an alaya only. Alaya is not the termination point of the mind, but that's what that statement comes from, yeah? Thus, according to Buddhist philosophy, reality must be grasped in this world and by this world, for it is that beyond which is also within. The Lanka compares it to the moon in water or a flower in a mirror. It is within and yet outside. It is outside and yet within. This aspect of reality is described as unobtainable or unattainable, anupalabhadra, and just because it is unobtainable in a world of particulars, the latter from the point of view of reality is a dream, like a mirage and so on. Yeah, I think they got it backwards. But that's because, once again, they're trying to shoehorn enlightenment into the alaya consciousness. But the alaya consciousness is the consciousness of forms, the energies of which we are formed. As long as you say that is the ultimate mind, then your mind is locked into the world of form, samsara. So how can you transcend that from within that? That's why this rhetoric of outside but within, within but outside. Well, outside is the ninth consciousness, but they just don't have that depth of understanding yet. Certainly Suzuki doesn't, and perhaps the Lanka doesn't identify it, but I'm really curious to see, as we read it, if we don't clearly see the ninth consciousness in it, albeit that at the time they weren't ready to get that. Maybe Suzuki as well. The subtlest relation or reality to the world is beyond description. It yields its secrets only to him who has actually realized it in himself by means of noble wisdom or prajna or arjnana. No, that leads to it. Right, Buddha wisdom is, again, in our earthly experience, samsara. But the actual engagement, the awakening to it, of it, is not of samsara. It's of the nature of the, you would say it's a reversal. Careful now. Remember, I keep telling you about the mind being an emergent property of this samsaric existence. But with that same language, I could say, and maybe should say, that that mind, once emerged, has as its origin Buddha-ness. And once you awaken to that Buddha-ness, one sees that all of samsara is emergent of the process, the Buddha, Buddha-ness. We just can't perceive it without this samsaric mind. They're in the conundrum. Something to chant about, yeah? This realization is also a kind of knowledge, though different from what is generally known by this name. Now he's going to get to one of my favorite words, epistemology. Of course you would talk about epistemology, because what is epistemology? It's another way of talking about the formative karma that amalgamates into our moment-to-moment manifestation with this emergent property we called mind. Where does that mind come from? How does it think? How does it distinguish? From what basis does it begin to identify and distinguish and discriminate? Right? That's psychology. That's epistemology. That's not... Where does the epistemology come from? Well, I'm sort of identifying that within the realm of samsara. It's a psychological discussion. But Buddha is not psychological. Buddha is the energy of formations. It's the entire engine. Not the power the engine produces, not the exhaust or the intake of the engine. It is engine. Without a theory of cognition, therefore, Mahayana philosophy becomes incomprehensible. The Lanka is quite explicit in assuming two forms of knowledge. The one for grasping the absolute or entering into the realm of mind only, and the other for understanding existence in its dualistic aspect in which logic prevails and vijnanas are active. The latter is designated discrimination in the Lanka, and the former transcendental or not prajna. To distinguish these two forms of knowledge is most essential in Buddhist philosophy. So yeah, that's a shortcut to something I'm constantly repeating. There's that samsaric reality of identification, possessing, losing, blah, 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 the cravings, yeah? And then there's the understanding that all of those energies precipitate from quiescence, that they are all endless forms of manifestation of different amalgams of energies. And that we, with our minds, are experiencing the great sparks, the fireworks, the precipitations of this energy. But we mistake the precipitations for reality. It's a reality we're in, but the true reality is that everything is constantly in flux, being created, constructed moment to moment from something far more essential, far more at the root of all things. And then we start to understand oneness and the suchness of each manifestation. The suchness of each manifestation of air molecules that we're breathing, as well as the bed, the chair, the television, the heart, the feet. Everything has at its root this engine of formations. And in that realization, we realize the differentiations are just provisional things we use in our differentiation, our dualistic realm. Right? Which has 3,000 possibilities in every single moment, thought moment of life. Thought moment. Why thought moment? Because that derives from this mind-only existence. Yeah? There's a consistency throughout all these teachings. It's fascinating to see how it's broken down with different language. Let's go on. The Lanka is decidedly partial to the use of Aryajnana instead of Prajna. Although the latter has been in use since the early days of Buddhism, Aryajnana, noble wisdom, is generally coupled with Pratyatma, or inner self, showing that this noble supreme wisdom is a mental function operating in the depths of our being. As it is concerned with the highest reality or the ultimate truth of things, it is no superficial knowledge dealing with particular objects and their relations. It is an intuitive understanding which, penetrating through the surface of existence, sees into that which is the reason of everything logically and ontologically. Reason. I'm not sure about that word. The Lanka is never tired of impressing upon its readers the importance of this understanding in the attainment of spiritual freedom, for this understanding is a fundamental intuition into the truth of mind only and constitutes the Buddhist enlightenment with which truly starts the religious life of the Bodhisattva. Religious. You can use the word religion as a set of behaviors that is constantly reinforced and repeated. In that way, the word is very samsaric. But be cautious to read into the word religion here a system of beliefs outside ourselves, powers, knowledge, so on and so forth. So for that reason, I don't like that he used that word, but he seems pretty comfortable with that kind of rhetoric. I identify it for you and for myself as something that can reinforce misleading thoughts, okay? I would rather use habit energies. This transcendental jnana is variously designated in the Lanka. It is pravikaya buddhi, that is an insight fixed upon the ultimate ground of existence. It is svabuddhi, innate in oneself, nirabhasa or anabhasa, imagelessness, beyond all forms of tangibility. Nirvikalpa, beyond discrimination, meaning direct empirical knowledge before analysis starts in any form whatever, which therefore is not at all expressible by means of words. The awakening of supreme knowledge, the Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, is the theme of the Prajnaparamita Sutras, but in the Lanka, the weight of the discourse is placed upon the realization by means of Aryajnana of ultimate reality, which is mind only. This psychological emphasis, so distinctive of the Lanka, makes this sutra occupy a unique position in the Mahayana literature. Okay, that's all good, right? That mirrors a lot of things that I've said. I'm sure some of you out there were going, well, that's what you say all the time. Okay, yeah. Fair enough. The knowledge that stands contrasted to Prajna or Aryajnana is Vikalpudbuddhi or simply Vikalpa, which I have translated discrimination. It is relative knowledge working on the plane of dualism. It may be called the principle of dichotomy, whereby judgment is made possible. But by us existing is by us existence is always divided into pairs of conceptions, thesis and antithesis. That is, being and non-being, permanent and impermanent, nirvana and samsara, birth, death, creating and created, this and that, me and not me, ad libitum. This is due to the working of vikalpa, the lakshana form of existence, thus presented to us is not its real nature. It is our own thought construction, vijnapti. But our buddhi, which seeks after pluralities, fails to understand this fact and makes us cling to appearances as realities. As the result, the world in which we now find ourselves living ceases to be what it is in itself, for it is one that we have constructed according to our own ignorance and discrimination. Reality escapes us, truth slips out our grasp, false views accumulate, wrong judgments go on adding complexities upon complexities. The habit energy thus created takes complete hold of the alaya vijnana, and alaya, the absolute, is forever unable to extricate itself from these encumbrances, encumbrances. Eternal transmigration to no purpose must be our destiny. There's the error. But everything else he said totally tracks, yeah? Again, many of you may be saying, oh my God, word salad, I'm lost, I don't get it. It's really a lot of words trying to define something simple, right? And I, at the risk of repeating myself endlessly, it is that borderline that the Lanka is trying to grapple with, because it ends at the eighth, the Alaya consciousness, of where can enlightenment be if everything that our mind perceives is by the very act of perceiving a construction, a qualifying, a saying, this is more, this is less, this, therefore that is that, and that is not that, but something, some other that. This is the dissection of our samsaric mind, the monkeys, all identifying their own very unique being and permanentizing it, my word, yeah? So in that mess of mind only, everything constructed as a mental cognition experience, where is the experience of emancipation? It must be something outside of our existence, something we cannot see but only aim toward, like the moon in the water. So there's an obvious necessity to transcend this analysis of life with an additional consciousness that is not within that trapped samsaric duality, identification, discrimination, and yet part and parcel of the same mind. There is that place. There is that thought realization, that openness. See how important the consciousness, the dialogue, the language of the consciousnesses becomes in our perception of awakening? Okay. That gets us to okay, so then that's the end of that chapter. The next one is the twofold truth. I'm not sure how he's going to proceed here, but that is where we are going to continue in the next video. It's getting a bit wordy, but don't worry. This again, this is Mr. S our author exposing his knowledge of Mahayana Buddhism and how it applies to his translation of the Lankavatara. So as a scholar, an academician, he can't avoid getting into these word salads. They're not to throw away. There's a lot of good information in them, but there's also little slippery slopes here and there. That's the nature of language, right? So I don't fault him for it, because I don't know what his true experience of Mahayana is. Maybe the Lankavatara is the pinnacle of his practice so far, and this is why he spent so much time understanding it, translating it, so on and so forth. If so, his practice hasn't evolved fully yet. But certainly in context of this book, we can see the stumbling blocks. Because we're Lotus Sutra Buddhists, we practice the ultimate, we can see easily, right, what our children don't understand yet. Oh, you shouldn't do that. Why? One day you'll know. As you get older, you'll find out. But that's very unsatisfying as a child, isn't it? And yet you can't deny you know something the child hasn't experienced yet. And you're fumbling with words to try not only to explain it to the child, but to apply knowledge that the child isn't ready to understand yet. That's the conundrum of everything we learn, right? So no different in Buddhism, I'm afraid. We all go through our growths constantly, even now. Thank you for listening. Thank you for liking, subscribing. Please do that. Helps offer our experiment, our sangha here, to more people using YouTube's algorithm. Yeah. Those of you who continue to either occasionally or occasionally or with what do they call it? Recurring donations, whether it's a dollar or more or equipment. So deeply appreciate your ability to commit to the propagation of Guanzon, right? That's what this is all about. Keep your practice strong. You guys are amazing. And in that, please, please be mindful of your health, right? Be kind to yourself. And I will see you on the next bounce. Okay. Take care again. And bye for now.